listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kurula. We're going to jump right into this interview. Tonight, we have living legend, Grammy Award winning, bassist of bassists, Mr. Victor Wooten. How are you, Victor?
Hey, thank you for the introduction. I'm doing very well.
It's funny. We have a lot of really similar philosophies. First, I just want to tell you how I discovered you 20 plus years ago. Okay. I was a classical vocal major at USC Thornton School of Music, and I love jazz and funk and blues. And I came to music school, and I found like classical music super confining, and it was kind of a heartbreaking experience because I loved all this other music, and the classical department didn't really kind of encourage that. And all my friends were jazz musicians. And so whenever I'd hang with them, they would throw Bella Fleck and the Flecktones on, and we would just listen to the intense musicianship that was going on. And that was the first time I was like, I remember thinking, who is this bass player? And a bass player friend of mine who was my roommate at the time, he actually kind of taught me a lot about music and playing with other people and writing and singing blues and jazz and funk. And he was like, this is Victor Wooten. He is the bassist of bassists. And you know, I just have always had this reverence for your playing. And the one thing that's really cool is I learned about music so much from a bass player. He was the one that put a guitar in my hands. He was the one that taught me how to sing on the music. And he was so adamant about showing me how important bass is. I think it's the most important instrument in a band because it is rhythm. It is harmony at the same time. It's really the only instrument that is that main foundation. And you started saying all these things in this book, and the book that I'm holding right here that you actually signed for me a couple of years ago when we met. And, you know, it was just so mind-blowing to read so much of your philosophies in this book. And we share so much of a parallel of how we look at music, how we look at making music, how we look at, like, you know, the stress that we maybe put on ourselves as artists to, you know, keep progressing, and also just the joy, the pure joy of making music. So, you know, I went down the rabbit hole listening to Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. I saw you guys play at the Wiltern. This must have been 98. And I got to tell you, it was one of the most magical experiences I've ever seen. Jeff Coffin was playing sax, Bella Fleck, you, your brother. And it was just like the most intense musicianship I'd ever seen live.
Thank you.
I just remember thinking, this is like a beautiful spectacle of just improvisation, writing, craftsmanship as far as music is, you know, concerned. And there's really just a joyful presence when you guys play, and whether you're solo or when you play with other people. And so we've met a couple times. We met at NAMM a couple times. We met at the Grammy Museum. And it has always been my dream to have this kind of conversation with you. So thank you for the amount of music that you put into the universe and inspired, because I will tell you, at every music school around the country, around the world, they are listening to you play, they are watching your YouTube videos, and you are such an inspiration to so many musicians. So first, I just wanted to tell you that as an introduction to say thank you.
Man, I really, really appreciate that, and I thank you for having me on.
Well, let's go back to the way back, because I know you started playing bass at 2 years old. First, I have to ask, a two-year-old cannot pick up a bass. How is that possible? Tell me what that experience was like for you.
Well, there are small instruments. My first instrument was a toy.
Wow.
And it wasn't about playing notes. It was about playing music. The same way a baby is born speaking.
Right.
It may not be considered English, but it's speaking still. The only thing that's not right are the words.
Right.
Right. But when the baby cries, you know what it means.
Right.
Right. The parents learn the baby's language right away. So the earliest I can remember playing music was my four older brothers. I'm the baby.
That's right.
They would set up playing. There would be a little toy Mickey Mouse guitar. I knew who it was for.
Right.
Right. And like, you know, my brother Reggie is the genius. I'm just the product. I'm the product of a bunch of geniuses. Right. Reggie knew that it wasn't time to start teaching me.
Right.
You don't teach a baby. You encourage them by including them.
And you're probably kind of taking in all the vibrations and just the kind of inclusion of it, which must have been super powerful.
Absolutely. Think about how you learn to speak.
Right.
Yeah. You learn to speak because no one's teaching you. What we call teaching, like correcting Yoda. You don't say it that way.
Right.
It's not a blankie. It's a blanket. Get it right. Go practice. You know, it never happens. That never happened to me with music in the beginning.
Wow.
It was just a toy. I sat around. There was an empty chair, a little toy plastic stool, and a plastic wind-up Mickey Mouse guitar. No one had to tell me twice. If my brothers were playing, of course, everybody looks up to their older siblings.
Right.
So I was jamming too. And so not long after that, maybe, and I have to say it started before too.
Right.
I say too, kind of to make it believable.
Well, because you were listening to music, I'm sure your whole family was playing music all the time.
I was lucky enough to get to play with them.
Wow.
That's the key. With no criticism, no correction. When a baby's doing baby talk, you don't correct them.
Right.
The baby thinks they're talking as clearly as you, right? You never tell the baby, you're a beginner. I can't talk to you yet.
Right.
Go talk to other babies first for years, right? Think about that.
So they were elevating you to the occasion, really.
Yes, bravo. So every once in a while when I'm on StreamYard, every 5 minutes or so, I see this little wheel.
That's all right. I'll be patient.
Okay, you're still. So I pause when I see it. Hopefully, you still hear me. But that's a very, very key thing. And you mentioned about classical. Classical, we criticize, and jazz too, because now jazz is being taught like classical. Right. There's a method.
Right.
And it's robbing the people of the freedom and the love of to do it your own way. Jazz is supposed to be your way.
Right.
And now we teach it as a method. And method, you always have to learn someone else's way. And you lose yourself in the process. Then they tell you to go find yourself again.
Right.
Right. No one's ever told you to go find yourself as a baby. Like, work on your speaking voice. Find your voice. No. It's not about your voice. It's about what you say with it. Right.
And was Reggie kind of like the band leader in the family? Was he
Yeah.
kind of like, you know, that's a
baby. But Reggie Roy and Rudy. Rudy plays sax. Rudy died too young. So a lot of people don't know about Rudy. Amazing sax player. One of the best you would ever hear. Played two at a time, like Wow. Rashawn Roland Kirk. As kids, two. He had an alto and a C melody. He was on horn section. So they're all Reggie Roy and Rudy. Guitar, drums, guitar, drums, and sax.
Yeah, right.
They're all very close in age. Right. Roy is not even a full year younger than Reggie.
Wow.
Right. And Rudy is 13 months younger than Roy. So they're only 2 years apart, the three of them. The way I hear the story, they started at the same time.
Wow.
They just figured it out.
And they gravitated towards certain instruments. They were like, I want to play this, just like kids.
Yep. I wasn't there, but that's what I hear. Wow. But then Reggie started teaching Joseph. And then Reggie started teaching me too. I think Joseph and I started at the same time. Reggie could see the band, right? So Joseph is 3 years older than me, but Reggie is only 8 years older than me.
Wow.
So if I'm 2, Reggie's only 10.
Right. This is crazy.
It is crazy.
10-year-old. This is crazy.
It's crazy.
Right.
Right. People think I'm crazy. No, I'm a product of crazy.
Right.
So think about how many 10-year-olds do you know?
That's not right.
It's teaching his 5-year-old brother keys, teaching his 2-year-old brother the bass. He can see ahead of what it's going to turn into.
Wow.
Has the patience, the empathy, right? The love, the knowledge, because he's still teaching himself.
And what were you learning? Were you learning? I know there was a lot of soul and R&B and funk, but you weren't getting into jazz at 10 years old, I hope. Please, thank you.
Not yet, but not long after.
That's a relief for every musician that's listening.
Right, yeah. But you gotta think about this. Okay, I was born in the end of 64.
Right.
So Reggie, 8 years older, what's that, 56, I think? The end of 56. Back then, radio was cool.
Right.
All right. So there were jazz stations. We were aware of it. There were R&B stations, soul stations, rock, classical, all that.
Right.
But the pop stations played, pop was just short for popular.
Right.
So if it was popular, it was on the pop station. So it could have been jazz, or better yet, it was jazz. It was rock. You'd hear the Beatles.
Ray Charles, I'm sure you're getting
Stevie
Wonder, you're getting a lot of the Motown stuff. And then it's mixed with some Elvis and Beatles. I mean, that's all that time period. Right?
All on the same station.
Amazing.
Called the pop station. So we were hearing it all. But when I was 5, we started doing gigs. So I remember we opened for War.
I saw that in your bio. And you opened for Curtis Mayfield, too.
We did Curtis Mayfield's Superfly tour. We were one of the opening bands.
That's crazy.
So I was told that I turned 6 on the Curtis Mayfield tour.
Did you get to meet him by chance?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
What was he like?
I don't remember. I was 6. I don't know. You know, I mean, seriously.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I remember very little of it, right? But Curtis was going to discover the Wooten Brothers. You know, that was the first time we were, you know, going to make it big. There's been a many, many different ones. And I'm very glad that we didn't make it very big back then. Because that huge success too early has ruined a lot of people.
Ruined
a lot of families, a lot of kids, a lot of parents. So we had opportunity after opportunity throughout my life. Lots of opportunities of who was going to discover the Five Brothers. Started with Curtis Mayfield. We were in the studio recording the record, I guess. I don't know what it was, but it never happened. But the thing I just want to point out is I get a lot of credit out of the Five Brothers. People probably know me the most. Victor Wooten's great. He's all this kind of stuff. Yes, I am great, right? I'm no greater than anyone else, but we're all great. I own that, and I admit it. But the real story is Reggie.
I mean, the parallel, what's so crazy, it's the Jackson brothers, really, because they were cultivating Michael in the same way. You know, it's like they were all musicians playing, arranging, and you know, it just came about like that. But it's
right.
But you're around genius. You know, there's something in the water. First of all, you're coming in Virginia. You're coming up in Virginia, and there's something in the water with the neighborhood that you're playing in, the kids you're playing with, and the family you're in. That's all enriching your musical experience. Were you ever like? Did you ever get burned out? Did you ever feel like, this is just, you know, not a serious thing? Or was it always fun for you even at that age?
It was fun. Now, there were times where I was sleepy.
Right.
You know, I'd have to come home on a Friday, do schoolwork, take a nap, and then we play a gig from 10 to 2.
Wow.
One break. But a kid will just do it. I didn't know anything else. But did I get tired? I have to learn a song for this wedding and the bride wants this song. So I'm sitting in my room. Reggie's teaching it to me. I look out the window. All my friends are playing in the street and I got to sit here and learn this hard song.
Right.
Did that? Of course.
And was he like working on your technique? Were you kind of doing that alone? Was it just kind of cultivating itself?
You play however it sounds good.
But right? You know what's crazy? The bass for a kid, that's tough on the fingers. I mean, it's tough on adults, you know?
Hey, you know what? Piano, kids play piano at whatever age.
Right.
They don't make a small piano for kids. They learn on a big one.
Right.
Kids don't know what they don't know.
That's true.
If you tell them, ooh, it's hard on your fingers, you know, I mean, what's harder than walking?
Right.
And kids want to be barefoot all the time. Your feet get tough.
That's true.
So that's why right now you won't find calluses on my fingers.
Your hands have advanced past calluses. That's right. Amazing.
Yeah.
What do you think was the moment of Zen that made you want to become a musician? Was it a song? Was it being in that environment? Was it all of it?
What's your first language, Nikhil?
My first language is English.
Okay, so let me ask this. What made you want to get good at English? When did you say, I'm going to speak English?
That's what you talk about that in the book. And I thought that was so brilliant because we don't think about it. Second nature, just music works in that same parallel. It's like, it's just what you feel and react and respond to.
It can work like that. Not everybody had what I had.
Right.
I'm just lucky or something.
Right.
I literally was born into it. I was literally learning to speak English and learning to speak music at the same time and in the same way.
That's
by jamming with people who are already good at it.
And were you gravitating towards any favorite bands that you had? Was it, you know, or were you just learning music and just trying to keep up?
I was keeping up with my brothers. Any little kid, you got four older brothers, man, you want to do everything they do. Play football in the street. Basketball up in the, you know, on we said when we didn't have a real rim, you know, we would play on the street poles, be a telephone pole, and they'd have these letters stamped on it. I don't know what they were, but if the ball hit the letters, you got a basket.
You know? There was a rumor that I heard. I don't know if it's true, but I heard Carter Buford lived in a very similar neighborhood, and you guys all used to jam together even as kids. Is that true?
It is true, but. So that happened later, and later is still really early.
Right.
So we first started playing when I'm 1 or 2 years old. We start playing in Hawaii. My dad was stationed in Hawaii. That's my earliest memory, but I never went to school in Hawaii. But we were playing already. When we moved to Virginia, I started school. We stayed in Virginia until I was starting the third grade. So up until around age 7 or so. But it's Virginia where we started gigging out.
Wow.
Doing shows, opening for bands and things like that.
Fairs and doing all that stuff too.
Fairs. Right? Again, at the big Oakland Coliseum, we opened for Curtis Mayfield, but War, Temptations. We did Battle of the Bands. We played weddings. We play at the Army base where my dad was working, Air Force base rather. You know, we would play anywhere. Then when we moved to Virginia, I started third grade. So I'm about 7 or 8 years old. That's when we met a whole new breed of musicians. Eventually, it was Carter, Tim Reynolds, who plays guitar with Dave.
Right.
A great saxophone player named Steve Wilson. Great bass player, James Genius, who's out right now with Herbie Hancock. So many great musicians that we started working out with. Now, Carter lived a good hour or so north of us, maybe even a little more.
You were in the scene together.
But in California and Virginia, if you were a musician, you were at our house.
That's amazing.
Always, because our garage was the central place for music. Everybody that played music showed up one time or other at our garage. And if you were good, people heard about you.
So the word got around, and you started gravitating towards bringing better musicians. And
absolutely.
Everybody must have been thriving off this environment that you created just within your family, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Your parents must have been so proud just seeing you guys put your energy into something so creative, so young, and so focused.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad fought in the Korean War, you know, and then he comes home and can't drink out the water fountain. You know, it's heavy racism time.
Right.
So when my brothers, older brothers found music, he made sure we had every opportunity to keep it.
Wow.
So he didn't want us to have to go that route. My parents were like, get an education, learn how to speak, know who you are so that the world doesn't tell you who you are. You know, whether we played music or not wasn't so important. It was who we were as people. Because if they could cultivate good people, they knew that we would bring that good person to whatever we did.
Right.
But since we found music so young, our parents made it easy for us to do it. So Dad always gave us the garage. If the house had a garage, that's where we jammed. And that's where the whole state jammed. I mean, if you were a musician, you were at our house.
Did you ever find any part of it to be challenging or,
oh, yeah.
You know, did you find yourself like psyching yourself out sometimes? Just
no.
You'd see other players or other bands, or was it always just focused energy, like progress, keep on working on technique? And
I mean, there was a time when I worked on technique because Reggie showed me something. Reggie showed me that I was doing some. That I had something that he hadn't seen anybody else have. And he pointed it out to me. So I worked on it. But when you're learning to talk, it's not about technique. It's not about your instrument. It's about having things to say.
Right.
We had things to say. If we heard Sly Stone and Larry Graham, it wasn't so much about technique as I want to say what he's saying.
Right.
You know? And technique comes in because if I play Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself with my fingers, it ain't the same. What's going on? How's he doing
that? Right.
So you figure it out. But now we learn technique with no need to play anything with it. We just want to learn it, but we don't know any songs.
Right.
We had reason. We got to play this at the prom. You know, we had reason for learning this stuff. And then, you know, later on, as I'm getting older now, and what I mean is like fifth grade, sixth grade, now Stanley Clark's out there.
Right.
And he's attacking. I can tell it's his fingers, but it's lightning fast with a bunch of attack. I want to do that.
Right.
Right? Hard is not in my vocabulary yet. It's not in a child's vocabulary until you learn that it's supposed to be hard.
Isn't it weird how that happens as you grow up into an adult? It's like there's a part of the ego that is almost silenced when you're a kid. And then you kind of learn those fears and you kind of develop that ego as you get older. Because I feel like I went through that just going through, like we have a parallel. Like I started singing professionally when I was a kid. So I was like singing in Carnegie Hall and singing at the Grammy Awards when I was 10 and 11. I actually met Miles Davis in 1990 when I was singing at the Grammy Awards.
Right.
And I thought it was normal. But it's like as I got to music school, all those fears and insecurities start creeping in about what you want to do and say as a musician. And you start seeing kind of like energies exchange as far as how music works and who's accomplishing what and this pressure that we kind of, you know, put on ourselves. What was so great about your book was just kind of understanding your philosophy and joy about the approach of music. And you know, the cool thing is, I'm sure when you wrote it, everybody was expecting another book that you were going to write that was going to be a clinic on bass technique. And what is so beautiful about it is you actually take everybody on this journey of vulnerability, of I'm not the person that has made it yet. I'm going to take you into that place where the musician is just trying to cultivate a culture and discipline and respect for themselves as a musician and grow as an artist. And one thing I have to tell you, I've read a lot of musician autobiographies, and a lot of times they leave out the most important part, which is this growth. And your whole book is about it. So it's a testament to your vulnerability, respect for music, and joy, because those aren't easy things to share. You know, nobody really is wanting to share those things because they're afraid of how it looks, but you just laid it out there. You were saying things in such a candid way that it was empowering. It was like, man, if this guy went through all the same things that every musician goes through and look where he is now, what a beautiful concept. So tell me a little about what made you want to write the book and when you knew it was finished.
Well, I started doing music camps, music and nature camps. I spent the 90s, 91 through 2001, I spent learning about nature. I think I've got a shirt on right now. Yeah. From a group of people that are really started with this man named Tom Brown Jr. And I read his book, The Tracker. And I said, wow, this is amazing. If this is a real man, I got to find him. I found him, started taking classes with him. And when he was talking about nature and awareness and tracking and inner vision, in my head, I'm saying this guy's teaching music.
Wow.
He doesn't call it music, but this is music. And better yet, or more so, this is how music should be taught. See, we're taught in music, and you talked about the classical thing. We're taught to, there's a right way and a wrong way. Right?
Right.
When you learn to talk, we learn your way. Whatever you say is right.
Absolutely.
So you learn quickly because nothing's holding you back. In music, you get told, when you start anything new, you're going to be wrong more than you're right. So if you get told you're wrong every time, who wants to continue?
Right.
Yeah. So basically what ended up happening is when after learning this nature stuff, I'm like, man, this stuff is helping my music. Other people need to learn this. So eventually I decided I want to do a camp. When I do the camp, I'm talking like I talk right now. I have a whole lot of different exercises. I know the main way, you know, the regular way. I didn't go to music school, but I still learned. I wanted to learn what was teaching in there. And they teach good stuff, but I think the method has a lot of flaws.
Absolutely.
And in many cases, if not most cases, I think we teach music in a way that's absolutely backwards. Practice first, play later. Mm-mm.
Yes, I totally agree. You give me chills because we share that same belief.
Well, we from what I'm learning from you, we had a similar upbringing.
Yes.
You know, we were doing it from young, and it didn't start with a bunch of rules first.
Nope.
Right? So anyway, people at the camps were saying, man, I've never heard any of this stuff. No one's ever told me that. You're making it easy. You need to write a book. That's exactly what I didn't want to do.
Right. You're like, don't give me more homework.
Well, it wasn't about the homework, but now it becomes a method.
Right. Right.
Right. My method is no method. Do it how you want.
Right.
You never teach a kid how to talk. You just let them talk. And if they have something to say, they'll figure it out quickly.
So the characters, I had to ask because Michael is a major presence in this book. Is he a figment of your imagination? Is he a real person? Is it taken from a bunch of experiences that you had with different musicians?
All of the above.
Wow.
All of the above. So what ended up happening is for years, no book. And it dawned on me one day when I was in my friend Steve Bailey's car. He picked me up from the airport. And he had a brand new book in his seat called Illusions.
I love that book.
Richard Bach.
I knew that you would. You know what's so crazy? When I was reading your book, I was like, I know he and I have read a lot of the same books because you were referencing certain things. I was like, man, Victor, you and I share so many philosophies. And I know it comes from the books and the things that we've been inspired by. Go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You're right. So Steve had that copy, a brand new copy in his seat, and I had to pick it up to sit down. And as I picked it up, I thought, man, I remember reading this book when I was, I don't know, 14, 13 or something, because my brothers were into it. I did everything they did.
Right.
And I told myself, the thought went through myself, man, I bet I could write this book now. Light bulb. That's the way to write the book people been asking for. Don't write it in a Wooten method that I got to defend and, you know. Write a story and let's call it fiction.
And right? What's so beautiful is you took these real concepts. Like, you know, what is really amazing, you know, like I've been touring with my band for the last 20 years and everything is about everything you talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. For me, the difference between a good band and a great band is dynamics. Everything's about phrasing. Everything's about space. Debussy once said, music is the space between the notes. So these are all philosophies that I've just gathered over time. And when I read your book, I'm like, we share the same concept on how to make music. And it's such a beautiful thing because there are a lot of musicians that don't share that same view in a lot of ways. It's a conversation that becomes something else.
Most of us are just playing or teaching the way we were taught.
Right.
And my brothers didn't do that. So I don't do it either. And when I look at the language I'm best at, it's English. How did I get so good at English? If you're 5 years old and can't speak clearly, there's a problem and your parents know it. They're getting help. But if you're 5 years old and can play music pretty well, you're a prodigy.
Right.
Right. So we treat it differently, you know. But anyway, to get to your question, the stories... No, let's put the stories in the book may be real. They may not be. It doesn't matter. What is definitely real are the lessons. And that's what's important. If I tell you that everything in the book happened, you weren't there.
Right.
So to you, it's still a story. So let's just keep it at it's a story.
Yeah, I love it. I love
it. And what was true, let it go.
Right.
Now, a friend of mine named Rod Taylor, He studied in college, degrees. He taught at Stanford, plays bass. We're longtime friends. He's the one that helped me shape the book. I had the ideas. I had the layout because I teach a class based on those 10 elements of music that I had been teaching for years. So I had the outline, but I needed to put it in a story that had a beginning, middle, and end. So I wrote it pretty quickly. Because I always teach music through talking about other things, tracking and stuff that, or language, something that you're already familiar with.
Nature, you had that reference too.
Absolutely. Right. But Rod, who really understands writing, helped me shape the book. I would type out a chapter in Microsoft Word. I would mail it to him. No, I'm sorry. I would email it to him because he was at Stanford. He would print it out, read it, and mark it with a big red pen like I was in school and mail it back to me. And it would come back with all this red stuff on it. But so he helped me make the book readable. And he told me some stuff. One of the first things he told me is that if you make your pattern, your characters off of real people, your characters will be more real. So I have a really crazy, in a good way, friend named Michael Kott, K-O-T-T, lives in New Mexico. Great musician, but crazy. I mean, he's right. Just like, it's like he just doesn't care what you think. He's going to do what he wants to do. So I said, okay, I'm going to pattern my main character after him, you know?
Well, it was such a vibrant character that you knew was shaking your earth. You know what I mean? It was shaking your world and you had to pay attention right away. You know, as a reader, you pay attention right away. Cause you're like, man, who is this guy? You know, right. You're feeling all those things that you're feeling as you're writing, you know, what you're writing, you know? Right. So,
If you ever meet him, you'll know it's him. Because I gave him that character. Now, he didn't say everything that the book says he said.
Right.
I just had real people. All the characters in the music lesson, all the characters except one, are based off of real people.
That's awesome.
Right. One of the characters I just had to invent. But I made sure I could see this person and everything to make it real. I'll share one other thing that Rod told me. He told me a lot of stuff and made me into a writer. He told me in the beginning, because I wrote the stuff that Michael says, you know, even if I heard my mom say it or Reggie, you know, I put it in Michael's words. At first, my character agreed too much with Michael.
Right.
And Rod said, no, you can't do that.
There's no compromise.
Like, Say it again.
There's no conflict.
Right, right. So I went, you know what? You're right. You're right. I need to represent the normal musician who doesn't get this stuff yet, who's struggling, you know. So I put that in there. I made my character not agree with Michael so much and push back, you know, and things like that. And so it became a much better book because of my friend Rod, even though I had the ideas and I had this, you know, the story, but he made it, you know, more readable, I guess.
Well, I'm going to just plug it real quick for every musician and musician lover and music lover, The Music Lesson by Victor Wooten. Pick it up. We're going to play something right now. We're going to play The Lesson appropriately by Victor Wooten. Here it is. Mm-hmm. So intensely ridiculous, man.
Wow.
Good. So wow. Good. A couple of shout outs I just want to give. So the guy that I lived with my freshman year as a music student, he's no longer here, but he was a bass player named John Scott Wakefield. And he would learn your solos.
Mm. And
show me through your music and through your solos that bass could be this incredible instrument to solo and be a solo instrument. And I think you kind of opened that door for him. And so I just wanted to, you know, give that shout out, because I know if he knew I was talking to you right now, he'd be flipping. You know, so another thing too, you know, when you start playing, there's so many things rhythmically you're doing, modally you're doing, you know, music composition that you musically composition wise that you're doing. You're throwing in counterpoint, you're throwing in some jazz theory. When you're doing all of this stuff, are you just flowing and just finding places to just find notes, like you say in your book, or is it the intent? Is the intent there to make it this composition and in this style?
All of the above. I'm doing all of it. This was my poor man's version of a great flamenco guitarist. Okay, I love flamenco, but I don't know really anything about it except how it feels to me.
Right.
There's rules to some of it, I think, but I don't know them. So I just came up with this song, but I wrote this song for the book.
Wow.
As I was writing the book, I came up with the idea, wow, what if there was a measure of music at the beginning of each chapter? So if you put all those measures together, you get a song. So that's what I did. That song, at least the main melody, is written in the book, one measure at a time.
Yep. It's each chapter.
Yeah. And it's amazing that a lot of people don't figure that out. Right. For me, if I see a piece of music in a book, I'm going to figure out what it says.
Well, it's funny. It's like you had me sight reading the each measure at the. So like I would literally sing the notes and go, OK, yeah. Cool. And then go read the book and then go to the next chapter. So it was right. I'm sure you were doing that. Like the intent was there to do that. But right. It was kind of a real signature of mastery. Because
I appreciate that.
It is like throwing nuance and subtlety with joy. You know, you love to write music.
But I tell you this, the way I wrote it is, sorry, my dog.
I've got a bulldog. He's waiting for me to go outside too. So don't worry. Yeah.
The way I wrote this song is the way I do it often. I sit right here. And I write and record at the same time.
Wow.
So in other words, I plug my bass into Pro Tools and I say, okay, how's this song going to start? I had the groove. I knew okay, good girl. Go on. I had the groove. I came up with that first. So I recorded it. And I got that groove, and I thought, okay, now where should it go from here? I come up with a little melody. Oh, that's nice. What's the bass note? Yeah, keep the same bass notes. How can I, you know, so, and I always come up with the bass line, the bass note, and the melody. And then whatever fingers I have left, whatever fingers are left, what note can I play? Oh, yeah. And sometimes I'll change the chord just because I can reach that note. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought of that. And so I come in with the next part. I record it because Pro Tools, I can punch in. I punch in the next part. And I listen. I listen from the beginning. Where should it go from here? And I recorded and wrote the whole song like that. Then I go back and learn it.
Wow. That's wild.
I did that with a lot of stuff. Norwegian Wood, More Love, You Can't Hold No Groove, You Ain't Got No Pocket. I do it all the time. I record. Now, recording has gotten easier. It used to be 4 tracks.
Yep.
You know, and then I had some Alesis ADATs and Tascams, DA-88s.
Man, I still do records on tape because I still think it sounds better.
Definitely so, does.
I do both. Yeah. It's tough, man, because it's like I love analog so much. And there's something about when I make a record, there's something really great about less choices. It's like it's urgent. It's like, you know what? We don't need 16 layers of guitars just because we can.
Right.
It's like, what does the song need? What does the arrangement need? So right. I love you do that when you compose too, because it shows kind of how masterful you are at writing and playing. You know, it shows your chord melody knowledge, your jazz theory, and it shows what I always find that great artists are familiar and unfamiliar. And that is exactly every time I hear you play, you do both. And that is perfect combination of finding something that is familiar to the listener, but also making it unfamiliar. So we're exploring and discovering at the same time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The thing that makes a song like that work is, at the risk of sounding egotistical or bragging, is that the rhythm is impeccable.
Right.
Right. Like I sit back and listen to that as if it's not me. And I say, that guy has incredible rhythm. Because with all that crazy stuff,
yep. All the subdivisions, yep.
That is solid. Even through the mistakes.
You can hear the backbeat as if there's a drum set behind you.
Right. Yeah. And I instinctively know, just because I live with one of the greatest drummers in the world, my brother, I understand that if I put a backbeat on 2 and 4, your body feels it harder.
Very true.
Right? But I also know that whatever's good about a song has to go away so it can come back and be good again.
Right.
So if you study that song, there's places where I take the backbeat away. So it feels more like you're floating.
Yep.
But that is still there.
Ebb and flow. And you know what is your internal time? You know, I know a lot of people probably ask you this, you know, at NAMM or master classes. Your internal clock is just a little bit more precise than every musician on the planet. And it's, I don't know if it's like a testament to you working with metronomes or if it's just something that's innate. I think everybody wants to know, do you work on it or is it innate? Is it just something that is just natural for you?
It's both. It's both. But here's the thing. If I know the benefit of hard work. Okay. Because I was born into a band, I was good without practice.
Right.
Okay. But I practiced, right? I've had good times since I can ever remember because I played with people
right
my whole life. I don't practice to YouTube, right? I play with people. If people aren't dancing, something's wrong. So I learned that as a kid before I knew what good time was. I was just doing what brother said and people would dance. As I got older and started realizing what was going on inside the music and realizing what nobody was teaching, I said, I'm going to get really good at this. And so I still work on it. And I work with a metronome a lot, but I work with metronomes in different ways.
You take away some of the beats.
I take away some of the beats. There's a guy that made an app based off of the rhythm chapter with Sam in the book.
Yep.
A guy made an app, a metronome called Inner Time. I-N-N-E-R.
Measure out, and then he takes 2 measures out, just like that?
Right. You hit a button, and Like if you're playing 60 beats a minute, God, you hit a button, it's still 60, but it's playing 30. Hit a button again, now it's 15 beats per minute. Hit a button again, now it's 7.5. So late, you know, I've been practicing, you know, at about 3 beats per minute.
Wow.
It's 3 point something. So I keep my same groove at 3%. And I won't go through it all, but I have other ways of really, really, you can make your time really, really good. So that playing normal music with a regular drummer is easy.
Right.
I'm like, man, I don't need all them beats. Just give me two every minute, and I got you. You know what I mean? But I worked on it. I did work on it. The same way a speaker works on speaking. They right. speak their whole life, but they get better at it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I have a very good friend named Jason Johnson who first told me about your book. Tremendous musician, great guitar player. And he told me about these master classes you were doing, where you were doing the metronome thing, where mm-hmm. you were, and like, he was telling me this, and I was like, wait, what? He was doing this as a master class? Like, and his time was on after not having any metronome for, you know, a minute, and his time was still on. And he was like, yeah, man, his internal clock is ridiculous. And it's like, that's something you know a musician works on, you know, like, yeah. But you know, there's also something when you start bass that young, it's also you're around an environment where you're aware of time. I have a theory that it's like, we don't get better as musicians, our ears get better. So it's like, as we are listening more, because the true art to music is listening to me always. I think it always will be. So I feel yeah. like there's some connection between your ears getting better and your brain. Because it doesn't make sense if you practice and then you go to sleep and the next day your brain fills in the blanks. It's your ear that's training with your brain, and you're getting better as you're just kind of like learning and progressing because yeah. your ear's getting better. Because I notice I hear more music than I've ever heard on old records. I'm sure you're the same, whether it's time, whether it's parts, whether it's intonation, whether it's arrangement. You hear things that you probably never heard when you were 5 listening to music. And I feel like your ear is kind of training your brain on some level. So that's my theory. It's weird. It's weird.
Absolutely. It's a lot of your ear. Having a good ear. And as a good friend of mine, a great teacher named Anthony Wellington, he pointed out to me that not only having good ears, but we need fast ears.
Yes.
Ears that recognize and respond quickly. But it's also feeling. Okay. I know people with good time, but don't feel right.
Right. Yes.
You know what I mean? But you can have bad time and still make it feel right.
That's very true.
You listen to some of them old jazz records, man, they're rushing and speeding up. You know, you might solo the bass part, which I've heard the bass part to Brick House. It's not totally perfect.
Right.
Right. So some things aren't supposed to be metronomically perfect. I don't do these exercises so I can be perfect. I do these exercises so I know where I'm at.
Right.
People talk about pushing the beat ahead or behind. You got to know where the beat is first.
Right.
Right. Then you have control over it. Right. A driver needs to learn to drive straight first before they learn to take curves and sharp curves at a fast tempo.
Well, what's great about your time and feel, it's like it's perfect. And then it has this right amount of grease that just makes it feel good. And like, that's something, no matter how many times you're in a practice room, you just don't get unless you're playing with people, you're experimenting, and you have that. That's what's so great about what you do as a player. And I look for that in players all the time. You know, it's like you and Pino are my two favorite bassists on the planet. And it's so crazy because I've met both of you and talked about collaborating on certain things. And it's just like, it's wild because you both are, you have the same thing in totally different ways. You have this precision and feel with the right amount of grease. And it's just anything you play feels good. And that is where it comes down to, is this joy of playing. You know?
Pino's got it totally. You know, and Pino's smart enough to not do all that crazy stuff I do.
Well, because, it's both. They're yin and yang.
That's Pino can do a whole lot more than we hear.
Right.
But a lot of times when people hear all that stuff, that's what they focus on. Right. Like a lot of the people who look at that song we just played, The Lesson, they see the technique involved and forget that this is feeling good.
Right.
Right. I'm playing by myself. So I need bass note. I need a melody and I need chords. So yeah, it takes technique to do it all. It takes technique to play piano. 10 right. fingers. I'm only using 4, maybe 5, right? But the key is why it sounds good is the feel.
I love when you play with the rhythm. Like when you're doing subdivisions, when you're slapping, you're doing 30 seconds, you're doing 64ths. I mean, it is crazy. You don't hear that many players that can do that. So there's a level of kind of like, how far can you take it, that I just mm-hmm. have the utmost respect. But then it has this, how musical can you be doing it? And that's the blend. I think that's everything. That's what you got. We're going to play Amazing Grace, speaking of which, because this is a very famous song you're known for. We're going to play Amazing Grace by Victor Wooten. Thank you.
thank you all very much. My name is Victor Wooten. Peace.
Such a heavy arrangement of such a beautiful song. I mean, honestly, I know everybody always wants you to play that everywhere you go. It's, you know, where I discovered it, it's was on Bella Fleck and the Flecktones Live Art. First of all, that record is one of my all-time favorite records of all time. New South Africa, one of my favorite tracks. Amazing Grace, there's so many. Sinister Minister. It's just, there's so much heavy music that you do solo and, you know, with your various bands. I've heard recordings you play with Dave Matthews Band, so many. You played with Prince, you played with so many people. What is next for you as an artist, and what do you find inspiring you to keep creating?
Nice. Yeah, music has done so much for me and so many other people. Music is one thing, one of the main things that brings people together of all types. Like, you know, when music's playing, we all just groove and no one cares who voted for who prays to who, how much money you make. The music brings us together. A band is better when all the instruments are different. So music shows how the world should be. So I'm always open to more opportunities to do that. But what I do have coming out, I think it's August 26th, I think, of this year, 2022. I have a new record with Steve Bailey and Greg Bissonette. It's called, the band is Bass Extremes, and the record is called Slow Down.
I just heard a track on your Instagram. I think you posted it a couple of days.
Yeah, we did. That has Marcus Miller, Ron Carter, and John Patitucci.
I mean, those are the cats right there.
Yeah, so there's different people on, you know, Justin Chancellor from Tool, Billy Sheehan, Otil Burbridge. There's so many great people. We got Mike Stern, great guitarist, who's playing bass on this record, six string bass, Bela Fleck on a bass banjo. So this record's all over the place, but it's centered around music from a bass perspective. So well, that's what's next.
I would love, you know, what I usually do on this show is I always have follow-up interviews every 9 or 10 months. Whenever you have an album that you want to talk about, I would love to have you back on the show. You're just a beacon of light when it comes to music, Victor.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you. I said it takes one to know one.
Man, you know what? Like, we're kindred spirits, and I hope we make some music soon and we collaborate.
Yeah. And, you know, if you don't mind, I'm going to plug one other thing. Steve and I, we brought back a website that we had, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years. Like what I do. If people like what I do and want to learn more and interact like this with me online, go to thebassvault.com. The Bass Vault. It's a membership website. I forget what the price is, but it's like, you know, buying maybe 2 cups of coffee a month.
And,
but what we do, what Steve and I do, is we make lessons, video lessons for the students.
Wow.
So people want to learn how to slap or whatever. You ask me a question, we make a video for it. And but then we come on, you know, every few times a month, we come on like this, and we talk about it. The members come on and we chat, and it's just like this. So it's a lesson site, and we have downloads. Some of the songs are written out. You can download it. So just check out thebassvault.com for people who want to learn what I do or what Bailey does. It's a great place. For us to learn and interact.
I saw you both and met you both at NAMM, and it was just crazy. Like, it was so musical and just inspiring. So keep doing what you're doing, Victor. You inspire so many music students, musicians like myself, and man, we just think the world of you. We're going to play a tiny little snippet of Sinister Minister because that was one of the songs that made me discover you. And on behalf of myself and Sam, thank you, Victor, for taking the time. I know it's late for you in Tennessee right now, but we appreciate all that you do. And thank you so much for sharing your life and story with us.
Thanks for speaking with me and having me on your show. Thank you.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening to us today. We had a great time playing for you. Howard Levy on the keyboards and harmonica. Victor Lamont Wooten on the bass. Future Man on the Syntax drumitar. I'm Bela Fleck on the banjo. Thank you, guys.
Corula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.